from deep inside your radio.
Oh, there's excitement afoot now. I can feel it. I just wish I didn't have to produce it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm a willing believer. I would love to be a more credulous human being, you know, because the ads look so good. I really would love to believe them. It is so tempting. And I'm not talking about, you know, just the petroleum companies are the best conservators of the environment type ads. But it's just the challenges increase daily to my granting of my credulity. The latest affront in that department is the television commercial for Botox. For Botox. Okay, now, first of all, Botox needs commercials, needs advertising, I guess, to combat the negative image created by, a stroll through Beverly Hills. But they have a television campaign now for Botox. You know what Botox is, botulism toxin that's injected into the face to get rid of wrinkles. And the truth of Botox, well established, is that when one has those injections, and one continues to have them because it has, about a six-month lifespan, the effect, and then you have to go have it done again. That's a good business to be in, by the way, where people have to keep going, coming back to you every 6 months. It's better than dentistry. Anyway, widely reported effect of those injections is that you, or in some cases Hollywood actresses, lose the ability to move their facial muscles in such a way as to indicate what the wearer's inner state of mind might be like at that moment. That is to say, one becomes relatively facially expressionless. So what is the theme and the theme song, harking back to the Watts 103rd Street Band of the early 70s, of the Botox television campaign? Express yourself. I swear. The commercial for something that renders you expressionless is express yourself. So I would love to believe more advertising, but not this week. Ladies and gentlemen, the number of sex abuse claims against Roman Catholic clergy dropped for the third consecutive year. So somebody in robes is not doing their job. But total payouts to victims nearly doubled to reach their highest level ever. So that would be a buy. I'd put a buy on that business. The buried lead department shows up with a story on the resignation, let's call it, of the chief executive of National Public Radio. Now, this followed a clash with the board, so we'll put resignation in quotes, but the buried lead is way down at the bottom of this story, where it says, on Wednesday, Ken Stern, the now former chief executive of National Public Radio, gave no hint of his plans as he announced that, and here we go, NPR had accepted a package of tax incentives from the District of Columbia's government to keep NPR's headquarters in Washington. Now, last time I looked, the District of Columbia is not, you know, Beverly Hills. It's not rolling in dough. I mean, and they're already up to their ears with the stadium. That's smart, paying for a stadium. So now they're paying tax incentives to keep NPR in Washington. Like, where are they going to move? Yeah, that's going to be really impressive. From Arlington, Virginia, here's the news. Well, there are people who do that. They're called the commercial radio networks. But still, that to me is the news. That to me is the lead. Yeah, goodbye, Ken Stern. But NPR held up the District of Columbia. Oh, held up. That's such a judgmental phrase. Ladies and gentlemen, the digital wonderland beckons. This from Multichannel News, advising me of the existence of a website I never knew existed till now. TVPredictions.com. I should have known. I should have seen it coming. TVPredictions.com president and publisher Philip Swan says the digital TV, and this is a quote, the digital TV transition is going to be the Katrina of technology. You're going to have, I'm continuing to quote, you're going to have incredible chaos, I predict, as we get into the second half of this year and into next year as the transition occurs, if indeed it occurs on the day it is now scheduled. He said he doesn't believe the public is paying attention to public service announcements. No. Last one I paid attention to had Smokey the Bear in it regarding the digital transition, and that it's 50-50 the FCC will push back the February 17, 2009 date for cutting off regular, that is to say analog, television. I think there's going to be an uproar of protest from the public when analog sets are rendered useless. I think people are really underestimating the potential for a lot of chaos, he says, echoing the opinion of the host of this broadcast, interestingly enough, which is why I repeated what he says. And the American Red Cross acknowledged that it lacks safeguards against paying for unused hotel rooms during natural disasters, a gap that may have cost it tens of thousands of dollars during the Southern California wildfires last year. So please give. Hello, welcome to the show.
Meet Harry the Swinger.
Yeah. Harry Shearer, I'm going to get you.
Thank you, Katie Couric. From the edge of America, from the home. No, I'm not at the edge of America. I'm nowhere near the edge of America. I'm at the other edge. I'm on the shores of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana. How could I forget? Oh. I've forgotten more than that today. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, time for news from outside the bubble. Performance-enhancing drugs banned in Olympic sport are being produced and sold in large quantities in China, where the games will be staged. That's called convenience. This is from the British newspaper The Telegraph. Human growth hormone, the drug of choice for athletes, poses the greatest threat to the Beijing Olympics, being drug-free, because it's difficult to detect unless tested for within 24 hours of being taken. Despite an attempt by the Chinese government to restrict its unlicensed manufacture and a complete ban on it on its export, it took a Telegraph reporter a little over a day to buy a week's supply and then to find another company willing to dispatch much larger quantities to Britain. China is the world's biggest manufacturer and supplier of anabolic steroids and of HGH. Well, then they should have the Olympics, said Andy Parkinson of British Sports Drug Unit. Any country that's seen to be producing designer steroids and other substances that enhance performance is a concern. We don't want the worldwide tracking of these substances. Two words, babe. Too late. On a more serious topic, not that drug-addled athletes isn't a serious topic, from the Asia Times, a skeptical view of the evidence presented by the United States to the IAEA regarding Iran. Dayline Washington from Gareth Porter. The Bush administration has long pushed the laptop documents, 1,000 pages of technical documents supposedly from a stolen Iranian laptop, as hard evidence of Iranian intentions to build a nuclear weapon. But those documents have been regarded with great suspicion by U.S. and foreign analysts. German officials identified the source of the laptop documents in November 2004 as the MEK, which is listed by the U.S. State Department as a terrorist organization. It's an anti-Iranian regime organization headquartered in Iraq. Here we go again, Department. There are some indications that the MEK obtained the documents not from an Iranian source, but from Israel's intelligence agency, the Mossad. In its latest report on Iran, circulated February 22, the IAEA, under strong pressure from the Bush administration, included descriptions of plans for a nuclear facility, technical specs for high explosives testing, and the schematic layout of a missile reentry vehicle. Iran has been asked to provide full explanations for these alleged activities. Tehran has denounced the documents as fabrications provided by the MEK and has demanded copies to analyze. The U.S. has refused to provide copies. The Iranian assertion is supported by statements by German officials. The German coordinator for German-American relations, Carsten Voigt, was reported by the Wall Street Journal in November 22, 2004, saying the information had been provided by an Iranian dissident group. If only there was an Ahmad Chalabi to verify them, be easier to believe. Speaking of Iraq, from the Australian newspaper The Age, Iraq is still violent and unsettled despite increased efforts by coalition forces, according to an Australian academic. Director of the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at Australian National University, Professor William Maley, said the situation is alarming, referring to the bombings this week. I think the bombings of this sort indicate is just how violent and unsettled the situation in Iraq still is. I think it's important to appreciate this, given some of the gushy comments that have been made about achievements of the surge, he says. Quote, the effect has been looking at the country broadly to reduce the frequency of bombings on the scale of the Bali bombings from something like once every 2.5 days to once every 6 days, he said. But it's still a frightening place to live, he added. From the point of view of people living within Iraq, this is still an extremely unsettled and alarming situation, And I don't think we should fall into the error of concluding that the situation has been normalized in any degree, unquote. Just an Australian. Nothing to look at here. Move on. Hillary Clinton had no direct role in bringing peace to Northern Ireland and is a wee bit silly, quote, for exaggerating the part she played, according to Lord Trimble of Lisnagarvie, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and former First Minister of Northern Ireland under the name David Trimble. Of course, this is in a British newspaper. We'll read about it in American praise because the, I don't know why. Quote, I don't know there was much she did apart from accompanying Bill Clinton going around, said Trimble. Her recent statements about being deeply involved were merely, quote, the sort of thing people put in their canvassing leaflets during elections. She visited when things were happening, saw what was going on. She can certainly say it was part of her experience. I don't want to rain on the thing for her, but being a cheerleader for something is slightly different from being a principal player, end quote. David Trimble of Northern Ireland. See, no American would use the word cheerleader in that context, I guess. There is a movement afoot to ban the plastic bag, shopping bags. I think one national health food supermarket chain, who would that be? There used to be two, is announcing it's phasing out the plastic bag. From the Times of London, scientists and environmentalists have attacked the global campaign to ban the bags. They say it's based on flawed science and exaggerated claims. The widely stated accusation that the bags kill 100,000 animals and a million seabirds every year are false, experts have told the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch. They pose only a minimal threat to most marine species, including seals, whales, dolphins, and seabirds. What are those? Oh, yeah, I saw a picture once. Campaigners say plastic bags pollute coastlines and waterways. The Times, however, has established there is no scientific evidence to show that the bags pose any direct threat to marine mammals. Says David Lace, the author of a seminal 1997 study on the subject. See, the seminal scare. Most deaths were caused when creatures became caught up in waste produce. Plastic bags don't figure in entanglement, says David Lace. The main culprits are fishing gear, ropes, lines, and strapping bands. Most mammals are too big to be caught up in a plastic bag. The impact of bags on whales, dolphins, porpoises, and seals ranges from nil for most species to very minor for perhaps a few. For birds, plastic bags are not a problem either. So birds take the rest of the day off. It's good news for you. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. But more about Iraq, because things are going so damn well there. From the Washington Post, two former high-ranking Shiite, can I say that on the radio, government officials charged with kidnapping and killing scores of Sunnis were ordered released this week. Prosecutors dropped the case against them. This renewed concerns about the willingness of Iraq's Shiite leaders to act against sectarianism and cast doubts on U.S. efforts to build an independent judiciary. The collapse of the trial stunned American and Iraqi officials, who'd spent more than a year assembling the case, which they said included a wide array of evidence, says a U.S. legal advisor who spoke on condition of anonymity because he likes his job. Quote, this shows that the judicial system in Iraq is horribly broken. Well, thank God we didn't break it, because that's... And it, quote, he continues, and it sends a terrible signal. If you are Shia, then no worries. You can do whatever you want, and nothing is going to happen to you. Meanwhile, Kellogg Brown and Root, the nation's top Iraq war contractor and until last year a subsidiary of Halliburton, has avoided paying hundreds of millions of dollars in federal Medicare and Social Security taxes by hiring workers through shell companies in the Cayman Islands. More than 21,000 people working for Kellogg Brown Root in Iraq, including 10,500 Americans, are listed as employees of the two shell companies that exist in a computer file on the fourth floor of a building in the Cayman Islands, according to the Boston Globe. The Defense Department has known since at least 2004 that the company was avoiding taxes by declaring its American workers as employees of Cayman Island shell companies. An official said the move allowed KBR to perform the work more cheaply saving dollars for the Defense Department. But the use of the loophole results in a significantly greater loss of revenue to the government as a whole, particularly to the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. Only one other major contractor in Iraq says it does something similar. Nice people doing nice things. Hey, they're saving the Pentagon money. And there will be a new national intelligence estimate on Iraq. Don't make your plans now for a party. It's going to be completed this month, according to U.S. intelligence officials speaking to the Washington Post. But leaders of the intelligence community haven't yet decided whether to make its key judgments public, as they did with the Iran NIE last December. And boy, did that hurt. Oh, sorry, November. The estimate on Iraq is intended as an update of last summer's assessment, which predicted modest security improvements, but an increasingly precarious political situation there. It's meant to be delivered to Congress before David Petraeus comes back to testify. Since the Iraq invasion, the intelligence community says the Post has been more cautious than the military and the White House in assessing political, economic, and security gains in Iraq. So we may never know what they say this time around because it's an election year. They wouldn't, you know, they don't like to meddle. You know, the intelligence community, as you know, doesn't like to meddle. Nobody likes to meddle in politics. Not even the politicians. That's why it took them this long to figure out what to do. I mean, the idea that leaders of the political parties who were, messing around with each other, the Republicans made the Democrats in Florida kind of hornswoggle them into voting to change the date of the Florida primary by including that in a piece of legislation that required a paper trail for voting machines, which nobody's going to vote against, knowing that it was going to put Florida at odds with the Democratic Party, which had said, we're punishing you for moving the if you move the date of your primary. And then they sat around till now. Till now it's a crisis. Well, that's the way you run your internal affairs, everybody. Why should we be surprised that that's the way you run the country? Are we? I don't know. And now, ladies and gentlemen, F is for FEMA. Nice people doing nice things. The Ute Indian tribe will soon move more than a dozen FEMA trailers from Texas and Arkansas, good night, to the Fort Duquesne area of Utah to help ease the housing crunch on the reservation. Do they know? Do they know what's in those trailers? The tribe initially requested 20 of them. Tribal leaders were pleasantly surprised when, after a lengthy waiting period, they learned that 13 is their lucky number. The trailers must be tested before they'll be officially treated to the tribe, although they don't say tested for what. We know tested for what. And apropos of that, Howard Frumkin, director of the Center for Disease Control's National Center for Environmental Health, told a Senate subcommittee this week, in retrospect, we did not engage the formaldehyde issue in the FEMA trailers as aggressively and as early as we should have, unquote. Really, Howard? And that would be why? By the way, formaldehyde levels in the FEMA trailers differ greatly. Four of the six most popular brands are among the most toxic, according to the Associated Press. Where are those people who are living in FEMA trailers living now? We don't really know. That's a good thing, too. It's all nice, nice stuff. But maybe somebody would ask Howard Frumkin, why were we not engaging the formaldehyde issue as aggressively and as early as we should have? Centers for Disease Control. Could it be possibly because of pressure from FEMA? No. That would never happen. See, I still have some credulity left.
She sat before me and told me how she had put an end to the pain right here and now, to that old squeaky wheel, the noose around her neck. She said, enough is enough, I've paid my debts. She's got a hole in the head where the rain fell through. She cared for so long, there's nothing she wouldn't do for everyone everywhere but herself. She said, I'm so tired of only having this sympathy, sympathy for everybody else. I need some sympathy for all myself. She's so hard on herself. Everyone, she's kind. She believes in the lies someone put in her mind. To that old squeaky wheel, the noose around her neck. Enough is enough, she's paid her debts. She's got a hole in the head where the ring fell through. She's cared for so long, there's nothing she wouldn't do for anyone everywhere but herself. She's so tired of only having this sympathy, sympathy for everybody else. She says, I need some sympathy for all myself. Ponies and horses, apples and pears. Well, everyone's different, but nobody's spared. Well, I met a woman and she told me straight that at 80 and aging, she's still full of self-hate. I want to stop it. I want it to end. I want me and myself to be the best of friends. I'm so tired of all the anguish of my critical self. I'm so tired of only having sympathy, sympathy for everybody else. I need some sympathy for all. I got sympathy for everybody else. I need some sympathy for myself. I've got sympathy, and it's
this is Le Show, and now, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Oh, you can hear as spring comes, he has even more vibrato.
We can listen to the warm.
Just warms up his chords, and they just start vibrating even. Ladies and gentlemen, Arctic tundra fires may increase significantly as a result of continued global warming. I bet you hadn't thought about that. What's happening with the tundra? Is it going to catch on fire? Apparently so. According to a new study reported in New Scientist that examines the relationship between changes in climate, vegetation, and wildfires in Alaska. And because a third of the world's soil-based carbon is locked in high-latitude tundra and forest ecosystems, the release of carbon dioxide from an increase in burning tundra could fuel further warming, according to the study's authors. Warming temperatures may increase the amount of vegetation available to burn by prompting a shift from tundra, comprised mainly of small herbs and grasses, to shrub tundra. Shrub tundra, suggests the study. As the climate changes, biomass will increase in the tundra, and with it will come more fires. I just love the name Shrub Tundra. That is my new party name, I'll tell you. And there's more, ladies and gentlemen. Scientists have used satellite images. Those rascals, they're at it again. To determine that an area of the ocean the Pacific Ocean, marked by low biological activity, kind of a dead zone, has expanded to reach Hawaii. Now, of course, sitting here in New Orleans, as I am, where this broadcast is originating today, there's a big dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. We know why that's happening, because of all the fertilizer that's being dumped in the upriver in the Mississippi. Why is this happening? According to Jeffrey Polavina of the National Marine Fisheries Service, the area is low on chlorophyll. The large portions of the area becoming less productive. That means there may be fewer larger fish and populations of smaller fish grow. Polavina and two colleagues analyzed 9 years of data from a spacecraft. The scientists said the least productive ocean waters are expanding, and the rapid expansion of low surface chlorophyll suggests global warming as the likely cause, according to Polavina. Remember when they... Now, see, here's how old I am, ladies and gentlemen. I'm old enough to remember when they used to put chlorophyll in toothpaste. They really did. That was supposed to be a good thing. But, you know, so is Botox. But maybe they could take all that old chlorophyll toothpaste and dump it in the... Just a suggestion. Just an idea. Don't... Hey, I'm trying to help. Now to a totally different matter. You know, you assume in the culture sometimes that things just happen. Things just, trends just start, kind of, if you're totally credulous, kind of start at the grassroots. And then you realize, wait a minute, this all happened because one guy started this. That's whom we have to thank. Well, in the case of boy bands in the 1990s, it's a guy named Lou Pearlman. He's in the news this week because this week he faced a federal judge, and while some in the courtroom snickered, swore to tell the truth was, he said, that he lied for years on end, spinning an illusion of prosperity that allowed him to steal more than $300 million from banks and investors. I'm accepting full responsibility, he told the judge. However, he did not apologize or show any sign of remorse. 53-year-old Pearlman lived a glamorous life as the producer behind the Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, and other bands. Now he faces up to 25 years in prison after admitting guilt to four counts of conspiracy to defraud banks. They're hard to defraud. Just ask subprime lenders. And investors, money laundering, and submitting a false claim in bankruptcy court. Who knew that was a crime? Under the plea agreement, he hopes to win a lesser sentence by helping the government find assets and by pointing the finger at accomplices. Wait a minute. I was a partner of... No, I wasn't. As further incentive, Pearlman faces additional criminal charges, including perjury, if he lies. When Pearlman was on the run last year, he lived on credit cards. After his arrest, he qualified for a public defender. Wow. According to the bankruptcy trustee, there's a fair amount of money still unaccounted for. He lied about investors' funds being FDIC insured. He lied about having a $50 million trust fund. He gave banks phony tax returns. He used a dead man's name on company documents. Asked about the money he raised, Pearlman, he spent it on, quote, different investments, different expenses I had. Those included artist development, grooming the boys, living expenses, working capital, blah, blah, blah. A $200 million judgment is being entered against Pearlman. He's required to forfeit all his assets toward that judgment and to pay restitution. Lou Pearlman is scheduled to be sentenced May 21st, his Windermere, Florida mansion, where he once entertained his boy bands. Nice, delicate use of words by the St. Petersburg Times. That's where he entertained his boy bands, ladies and gentlemen. I thought they were the entertainers. Well, you know, entertained. You know what I'm saying. He entertained them. See what I'm saying? That mansion is scheduled to be auctioned this week, but it was heavily mortgaged And banks with liens get paid before creditors. It's like Neverland, only wetter. Well, more humid, let's put it that way. Lou Pearlman, the saga will continue moments from now here on the show.
I can be happy, I can be sad, I can be good or I can be bad. It all depends on you. I can be lonely out in a crowd, I can be humble or I can be proud. It all depends on you. I can save money or spend it, go right on living or end it. You're to blame, honey, for what I do. I know that I can be beggar or I can be king. I can be almost any old thing. It all depends on you. Gang of money, even spend it, go right on living, or maybe end it. You're to blame, baby, for what I do. I know that I can be beggar or I can be king. I can be almost any old thing. It all depends.
Back on this very special Larry King Live, which is the last one we're doing before the next presidential debate, which we're having right here tomorrow night. We taped it a couple of days ago. But more about that the next time I have to promote it. In our Los Angeles studio is the great Dewey Gordon. He started his meteoric career at the top with the boy band Boys Are Us. He's become a successful solo act in many states of the union. Dewey, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Mr. King. It's always an honor. And I guess the more I come back here, the more of an honor it is.
Jesus, do we? Even I don't kiss up to people that much. You've been doing what lately? Movies? Concerts? We haven't seen a lot of you on TV.
Well, it's strange, Mr. King, because I've been part of a really fun, really groundbreaking reality series called Don't You Know Who I Am?
Oh, yeah.
It puts a bunch of us from, I guess you could say, the 90s into real-life situations right now where we have to try to get something special, you know, special treatment or help or something.
Yeah.
You know, I have a hot date at a fancy restaurant. This one actually happened to be on the show. And they don't have my reservation, you know, and it's Saturday night. The way I can deal with it in the rules of the show is to say to the guy, don't you know who I am? Yeah. And if it works and you get the table, let's say, then you get to stay on the show. It's on Oxygen, too, and we're doing well enough. I think we're going to migrate to the mothership next season.
The mothership being?
The main Oxygen channel.
Yeah. That's mainly a channel for what, women?
Yes, sir. Yeah. That's its positioning. But I think with this show and another one that my company's producing, Death Row Women, we're expanding their audience demographic just a little bit, but...
But that's not why you're here, Dewey. No. You got a new song you just released.
Yes, sir. It's a digital download available on my site, of course, boynomore.com, and it's going to be on all the digital sites real soon. It's a tribute song, Larry, because, well, when you get right down to it, sir, it's the one thing I've never really done.
Well, besides having a platinum single as a solo artist.
Well, that too. But this is something that's very personal to me. I just went to the studio this week with my producer, the amazing Monkey C, because, you know, a tragedy has occurred to a giant of this business, Mr. Lou Pearlman.
He's the guy that, what?
Well, he was only the man, Larry, who invented the boy band, you know, period, paragraph, new page. Basically, he said to all the good-looking young guys with decent voices and some dance moves. Hey, I can make you bigger than Madonna. And now he's fallen on hard times. Apparently he's been involved in some dealings that I don't really understand, you know, financial stuff that artists never really get into. But Larry, none of the other ex-boy band boys have stood up and spoken up or sung up for Lou. And so, as I say, Monkey C and I just went into the studio. And, you know, some magic happens, as it does when your heart's really into it. And, you know, hey, I can make a million with this or $2. I don't really care. It's just a way of saying thank you, Lou Pearlman.
Dewey, was Boys R Us one of his bands that you knew him personally?
No, sir. Our own Svengali, Mr. Bert Lipschitz, was kind of an apprentice or a mentor of Lou's. You know, he had access to all of Lou's legal forms and everything. Yeah. And, you know, some days when we'd been in the bus and Bert would come back to our section, he'd talk a little bit about his dream, which was being bought out by Lou. It never happened, which is part of Bert's sadness. But, you know, when Lou gets out of jail, Larry, I'll still be a relatively young man. And
you'd like to work with him then?
Oh, well, who can know the future? Yeah. But in the meantime, I wanted to be one boy band member who didn't forget where it all started.
Okay, it's called He Brung the Noise.
He Brung the Noise.
He Brung the Noise. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a typo in the prompter. It looks like noisy.
It's not a typo, Larry. That's urban.
Yeah. Well, then call me suburban. Dewey Gordon's new song, He Brung the Noise. You're hearing it here first.
I never worked for you, although I wanted to, Lou. You had the golden key, the laces for the golden shoe, Lou. The boys in your attic belong to the world. Did you love them too much, or did you just have accounting problems, Lou? You brought the boys, sweet Lou. You brought the noise, yeah, you. You brought the boys, oh, you. You brought the noise. Whimsy and fiction too, just what you liked to do, Lou. You had the fairy dust, and so it grew and grew, Lou. Dead men have no lawyers, there's no magic in rules. I'll be in your band and solve your accounting problems, Lou. You brought the boys over. The boys and you. You brought the noise.
Dewey, I wish we had time for the whole thing.
I do too, Mr. King.
But they're just going to have to go to what? Your website?
My website, or, you know, maybe CNN's.
Yeah, you don't want to be on our website too crowded. The great Dewey Gordon, as much of a classic as the Corn Riot in Nathan Al's. We got to end early tonight to make way for this announcement from Los Angeles. Good night.
A new kind of debate for a new kind of debate season. The Larry King Democratic Debate, featuring questions taken exclusively from Larry King's columns.
Is there any better summer fruit than a peach, Senator Obama?
Larry, I'm going to have to say the Kelsey plum.
That's the green one, right?
It is.
Senator Clinton, your answer.
The pluot, Larry. It's half plum and half apricot.
The Larry King Democratic Debate, tomorrow night on CNN, the first name in last words.
I feel so damn good, I'll be glad when I got the blues. Yeah, come on, come on. And I feel so damn good, I'll be glad when I got the blues. Come on. And I'm so down being up, I'll be winning when I start to lose. Well, come on. Good. Got to have a little run with the spoons. Lots to eat when I'm standing still. Yeah.
street. I feel so damn good. I'll be glad when I got the blues. I'm so down in love. I'll be winning when I start to lose. Yes.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, the first one, I think most of you know that Barack Obama Foreign Affairs Advisor Samantha Power resigned after calling Hillary Rodham Clinton a monster. She's an unpaid foreign policy. Harvard professor, I think she gets paid at Harvard. Sure hope so. Announced her resignation, in which she expressed deep regret. Last Monday, she said, "I made inexcusable remarks that are at marked variance from my oft-stated admiration for Senator Clinton. And I extend my deepest apologies to Senator Clinton, Senator Obama, and the remarkable team I've worked with over these long 14 months." Maybe too long? Regarding another controversy that swirled about the Democratic campaign, the Canadian embassy and our consulates general, says a statement by the embassy, regularly contact those involved in all the presidential campaigns and periodically report on these contacts to interested officials. In the recent report produced by the consulate general in Chicago, there was no intention to convey in any way that Senator Obama and his campaign team were taking a different position in public from views expressed in private, including about NAFTA. We deeply regret any inference that may have been drawn to that effect, unquote. Canadian embassy. But enough about politics. A Kissimmee, Florida homeowner was in England when he learned a Florida bank had mistakenly started foreclosure proceedings on his house. It turns out Denroy Bell didn't even have a mortgage with the bank, City Residential, part of the City Group. They're doing so well these days. The bank admitted it's dealing with so many foreclosures in Central Florida that it made a mistake. That's a good economic indicator. The bank is sorry. Rabbi Herschel Schachter apologizes for saying Israel's prime minister should be shot if he gives away Jerusalem. When asked if Jews should serve in the Israeli army, Schachter, a top rabbi at Yeshiva University, said, quote, "If the army is going to give away Jerusalem, then I would tell everyone to resign from the army. I'd tell them to shoot the prime minister." A video of the remarks was broadcast on YouTube. Schachter issued a statement of apology on Thursday. "Statements I made informally have been publicly excerpted this week," he said. "I deeply regret such statements and apologize for them. They were uttered spontaneously off the cuff and were not meant seriously. And they do not, God forbid, represent my views, unquote. Okay? Am I off the hook now? A Texas oil executive was sentenced Friday to 2 years in prison for approving the payment of millions of dollars in kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's Iraq regime so he could secure large oil shipments through the Oil for Food program. David Chalmers was fined $9 million. And the companies that Chalmers ran were sentenced to 3 years probation. Gee, I'd like to be the probation officer for an oil company. I didn't think through all the consequences at the time, and I'm sorry, said Chalmers. In my heart, I should have known it was wrong. He says he carries heavy, heavy guilt. Heavy, heavy guilt. The gripping memoir of Margaret B. Jones received critical raves. It turns out it should have been reviewed as fiction. The author of Love and Consequences, a critically acclaimed autobiography about growing up among gangbangers in South Los Angeles, acknowledged this week she made up everything in her just-published book. Jones is actually Margaret Seltzer instead of being a half-white, half-Native American who grew up in a foster home and once sold drugs for the Bloods. She's a white woman who was raised with her biological family in Sherman Oaks, California, and graduated from an exclusive private school in the San Fernando Valley. Her admission she's fake came in a tearful mea culpa to the New York Times, which last week published a profile of her using her pseudonym. She was unmasked when her sister Cindy Hoffman saw the newspaper's profile and the photo of her and notified the memoir's publisher that Seltzer's story was untrue. Seltzer's mother says her daughter is very upset and contrite about the fabrication, but had been advised by her editor not to speak further about it at the moment. I think she got caught up in the facts of the story she was trying to write, the mom said. She's very sorry and very upset, unquote. Dateline Little Rock, Arkansas, the leader of Little Rock's Roman Catholic diocese apologized, strangely enough, to a national breast cancer organization, saying he made a mistake when he said donations to the group could help fund abortions. Monsignor J. Gaston Hebert, or Hebert, it's Arkansas, I'm sure it's Hebert, issued the statement after a meeting with staffers from a Dallas-based organization known for its Race for the Cure events. Hebert said his contention that donations to the Race for the Cure events could free up funding for abortions turned out not to be true. A staffer working for Representative Steve Chabot of Ohio apparently broke House rules, forwarding a request that congressional staffers send interns to the Republican National Committee to make campaign phone calls. It raises questions as to what else is taking place in Congressman Chabot's office, said the Democrats. Chabot spokesman George Sikala apologized for the incident. It's not our office policy to conduct business this way. We apologize if there was an appearance of impropriety, which was certainly not our office's intent. We apologize to the folks back home. That's an if apology. You got to work a little harder. Google Earth has been banned from surveying U.S. military bases after it took street-level photographs of a Texas Army base. The Department of Defense believes the photographs could compromise security and has ordered base commanders to prohibit Google Earth teams from driving their picture-taking vehicles onto military property. Google spokesman Larry Yu has apologized for the mistake. The company has taken the offending photos offline. No, it's you. It's you. Pro golfer Tripp Eisenhower apologized for killing a hawk that was making noise while he tried to film a TV show. Eisenhower, who plays on the developmental nationwide tour, was charged with cruelty to animals and killing a migratory bird. Eisenhower said he's an animal lover and his family has adopted 3 cats from a local shelter. In a big hurry, I bet. He killed the bird by driving golf balls at it. That's what he did. True story. Austin, Texas Mayor Will Wynn is apologizing for his behavior at a party 2 years ago, saying he's embarrassed by his own behavior. He pleaded no contest to misdemeanor assault following an incident at a St. Patrick's Day party at the mayor's residence. The mayor is accused of grabbing a man by the arm, escorting him out of the party, then following the man to the sidewalk, then grabbing around the neck, choking him, and telling him to get out of Austin. 2 years ago, I let stranger push my buttons, and I really lost my cool. I wish the incident had never occurred, and I apologized 2 years ago. In the heat of that anger, I also said a bunch of stupid, insulting things that I immediately regretted. I apologize for them. Now I feel the need to extend that apology to all my city colleagues. In fact, our entire citizenry. And once the chief of staff of the governor of Alaska, Jim Clark, is now a convicted felon pleading guilty to a federal conspiracy charge stemming from an illegal effort to re-elect his boss, Governor Frank Murkowski, in 2006. What? There's corruption someplace besides? I'm shocked. I've got a lot of atonement to do, Clark said. No one is more aware of my inappropriate conduct than I am. For this, I sincerely apologize to all Alaskans. Unquote. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over the NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. Yep, the BBC's off shortwave, but we're still on. Around the world via the Internet. From a different century, at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. Available as a free download at www.audible.com and available as a slash the show. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And be just like those FEMA trailers. Don't poison the Indians. If you'd agree to be with me there. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Uh-huh. Want to email the host of this broadcast? Want to find out what the music is being played on the broadcast? Go to harryshearer.com. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks, and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans for helping to make today's program almost possible. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.